Welcome to the LACNETS podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Yen. I'm the LACNETS Director of Programs and Outreach, as well as a caregiver and advocate for my husband who is living with NET. In each podcast episode, we talk to a NET expert who answers your top 10 questions. This podcast is for educational purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. Please discuss your questions and concerns with your physician.
Welcome to the LACNETS podcast. I'm really excited to introduce our speaker for today, Dr. Edward Wolin. Dr. Wolin is the director of the Center for Carcinoid and Neuroendocrine Tumors at the Tisch Cancer Institute at Mount Sinai and professor of medicine, medical oncology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. He is an internationally renowned authority on neuroendocrine tumors. He pioneered many of the neuroendocrine therapies, including somatostatin analogs, such as lanreotide and octreotide, peptide receptor radiotherapy, otherwise known as PRRT or Lutathera, and targeted therapies such as everolimus or afinitor, sunitinib, most recently cabozantinib, and he's published in many prestigious journals, including the New England Journal of Medicine, Journal of Clinical Oncology, and he's a reviewer for numerous journals as well. We are proud to say that during Dr. Wolin's two decades at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, he was instrumental in founding and launching LACNETS and guiding us in our early stages. He has been the host, speaker, and supporter for our educational programs during the early days when we were a small local support group in Los Angeles and have since grown, and he continues to be involved, and we treasure our long history and close friendship. Dr. Wolin has been a dear friend to both LACNETS and our founder and dear friend Giovanna Joyce Embesi. A fun fact that I'd love to share about Dr. Wolin is that he is a lover of classical music, and he can play the clarinet and recorder. And his wife is a concert pianist like our founder, Giovanna Joyce Embesi, as well as my husband, who's also a pianist. So many things that we connect on, not just nerding out on nets, but also on music. So Dr. Wolin, welcome. And I'd love for you to share how you got into the field of net.
Approximately 25 years ago, I had a few patients with neuroendocrine tumors come to see me before I was a specialist in carcinoid and neuroendocrine tumors. One of these was a nurse, a very sophisticated lady who was the chief nurse at a busy hospital emergency room at a university, who came in literally in a wheelchair on an outpatient PCA pump of morphine with severe intractable abdominal pain, for a second opinion about whether she should listen to her university oncologist who she had seen, who recommended she go on hospice. And she said, before giving up and going on hospice, I wanted a second opinion. So I looked at her CT scans that she had at the time, and it looked like 3/4 of her liver was filled with metastatic neuroendocrine tumor, but there was a quarter of her liver didn't have anything except for one small spot. And I said, I know a liver transplant surgeon who can get all of that out of you, and referred her to a very, very experienced liver transplant surgeon who said, yes, I could do that hepatic trisegmentectomy, take out all that tumor, ablate the one tumor that remained in the piece of liver that was okay, and that she would have enough remaining liver to regenerate and live. She had an operation that probably took 11 hours. And they did that operation and at the same time took out all the other disease that started in her pancreas and had spread in her abdomen. And all of that was taken out and she was free of detectable cancer after that surgery. And then I treated her with somatostatin analog therapy. And she lived for years and years and years and years and years doing wonderfully. Went back to graduate school, traveling around the world, doing everything she wanted to do. And I said, wow, this is amazing. And at that time, there was no approved treatment for a carcinoid tumor or any neuroendocrine tumor in the United States, except for one old drug called streptozocin that's hardly used these days. But there was no treatment otherwise for neuroendocrine cancer. And everything that has to be done off-label. And the people that she was seeing were not carcinoid specialists. They were experienced gastrointestinal oncologists, but just weren't aware of what was possible. The second patient I had that same year had a neuroendocrine tumor that started in the larynx. And she was told that she needed to have her entire larynx removed and have no voice box and be unable to speak in order to get that tumor out because it was pretty extensive in that area. And she was a very intelligent lady. and did her own research a little bit, like so many neuroendocrine patients do, and advocate for themselves a little bit, like so many neuroendocrine patients do. And she said, why do I need my entire larynx removed when people that have the worst larynx cancers in the world can be treated with chemotherapy and radiation and still preserve their voice box? She said, I'd rather be dead than have no voice box. And I said, you know something, you're right. So even though a lot of well-known people had told her she couldn't do anything except have a total laryngectomy, we treated her with chemotherapy and radiation. Her cancer came under excellent control. She also was able to be managed with a somatostatin analog, just a normal injection. At that time, lanreotide wasn't out, so she had octreotide LAR. That's all we had. As I was in California, she was still doing well. Not that these people couldn't have a recurrence. Not that she might one day, many, many years later, need a laryngectomy, but she had a life that she never would have had otherwise. And after I saw these two people, I said, this is not right. If nobody else is going to master the field in the West Coast, I might as well do it myself. So I got in touch with Dr. Richard R.P. Warner, who was at Cedars-Sinai at the time, and who was very encouraging and a mentor not only to myself, but to probably a whole generation, or many generations, I should say, of neuroendocrine physicians. And I started doing lots of research, going to lots of national meetings, and became the principal investigator at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, where I was for 26 years, for doing the clinical trials that led to FDA approval of lanreotide and everolimus and PRRT with Lutathera, lutetium-177 dotatate. My whole professional career has been in trying to stamp out neuroendocrine cancer in America. And it's just those two patients changed my life. So that's what happened. So we definitely learned from our patients, and we do our best to help everybody.
What a remarkable story, Dr. Wolin. It's so inspiring on many fronts. One is that, as you said, patients inspired you. Two is that those stories are very relatable to many people in the audience. You know, many people who were told one thing that they didn't have long, hospice recommended, different kind of really radical surgeries or treatments recommended. And then another thing is the focus on the quality of life. That's what we're all after, right? All these treatments are a means to an end, and you saw that and you were able to pave the way so that these two patients and many more directly and indirectly are able to not just survive, but thrive. So thank you for that. Thank you for pioneering this area and many treatments for this so that people can thrive.
And just one more comment. This made me realize that when you're dealing with outrageously rare diseases where there aren't standard algorithms for treatment and you can't just look up a recipe for what to do, that experts need to talk to each other. And at that point, I started a weekly neuroendocrine tumor board where all the various specialists and surgical specialties and interventional radiology and oncology and endocrinology and gastroenterology and everybody all talk to each other and meet every single week. And I did that the whole time I was in California, and I do that every single week at Mount Sinai in New York, where I am at present. And that makes all the difference in the world to personalize care and to think out of the box when there is no standard treatment for something. At that time, there were no medications that were standard treatment. Now we fortunately have gotten several standard treatments approved, but so many people can't be treated with standard things because they're already resistant or not able to receive them for one reason or another. And we have to always keep exploring the boundaries of what's possible.
Yeah, exploring those boundaries, pushing those boundaries so that we can keep expanding the field. Well, thank you for that, because you just highlighted the importance of the multidisciplinary team, experts talking to each other, and then patients finding those experts and multidisciplinary team as well. So we're really grateful for all your work in the field. And specifically for today, we're going to talk about somatostatin analogs. So this is a perfect topic for you, given all that you did in this field. So in the past, we've talked and focused different podcast episodes on different types of NETs, such as pancreatic NET, small bowel NETs, hindgut, rectal NETs, lung NETs. But in this series, we're going to focus on treatments for neuroendocrine tumors or neuroendocrine neoplasms. And today, our topic is somatostatin analogs, or SSAs, which is often dubbed in the community as our monthly shots. So, Dr. Wolin, our first question for today is simply, what are somatostatin analogs, or SSAs, and how do they work?
Somatostatin is a natural hormone in the body that is nature's turn-off signal in the endocrine system. you eat a chocolate bar and your body starts making insulin because you're not a diabetic. And the insulin keeps your blood sugar from going too high. It lowers blood sugar, but it keeps lowering and lowering and lowering. And if it was unimpeded, it would go all the way down to the point you'd be on the floor having a seizure with severely low blood sugar. That's not acceptable. So what happens in the body is that as soon as the blood sugar becomes normal, a little burst of somatostatin will stop insulin from getting produced, and the blood sugar stays at a normal range. Well, it turns out that not only is this a signal that turns off hormones, but it also turns off growth of neuroendocrine cells. And that's something extremely important. And it turns out that natural somatostatin lives in the body only for 2 or 3 minutes. But somatostatin analogs have been made, like octreotide, sandostatin, or lanreotide, somatuline. Those are somatostatin analogs. And those could work in the body for 4 weeks or so at a time. And they turn out to be wonderful therapies for turning off the growth of neuroendocrine cancer. And the amazing thing about them is they do it without causing severe side effects. Even though they're turning off so many different hormones, the effects on the body are usually very tolerable and the side effects are not too bad. Turns off insulin a little bit and it turns off glucagon a little bit at the end of the day. Most people's blood sugar is not too out of whack. Some people's blood sugars can go up. Some people who are already diabetic end up needing more insulin, for example. But most people tolerate it very well, and it's the same with other hormones that generally works out well, and it controls cancer for years and years, as we'll talk about soon. Now, the somatostatin analogs that we're using right now are primarily octreotide LAR, which goes by the brand name of sandostatin. That is the generic name, and the brand name is sandostatin LAR. That is one, and the other one is called lanreotide, which goes by the brand name of somatuline depot. Or in Europe, it's called somatuline autogel. It's the same product. And those are the two somatostatin analogs.
Thanks for that overview. So I'm wondering, when are the somatostatin analogs used and how are they used?
Well, the somatostatin analogs are used for two purposes. One is to treat carcinoid tumors to keep them from growing, and neuroendocrine tumors encompass carcinoids as well. I'm sort of throwing out the word carcinoid because that's what patients often call these things, but the pathologists call them all neuroendocrine. But it stops these tumors from growing, and that's very valuable because it could stop them from years. The other thing that's very valuable is it can stop the excess hormone production from neuroendocrine tumors, and that means it can be used to treat carcinoid syndrome. And it can also be used to treat other hormone secreting syndromes that pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors have. It can stop those hormones from getting made as well. So it's very valuable for both of those activities. There are differences between the two major somatostatin analogs, octreotide and lanreotide. Octreotide was first to come on the market, octreotide LAR. It's a deep intramuscular injection every 4 weeks. The original trials were done as a drug to improve carcinoid syndrome, flushing, and diarrhea. And there were very highly successful trials, and it was approved by the FDA for treating carcinoid flushing and diarrhea. It was not a study that was designed to look at anti-cancer effectiveness. And in fact, the patients weren't even required to have any imaging to look at the size of their tumors. It was only a study for flushing and diarrhea, and that's what it's been approved for. And for this day, that drug is only on the market for treating flushing and diarrhea in the United States, and all treatment of tumors using it is off-label. The only study that was a phase 3 trial to evaluate the effectiveness of octreotide as an anti-tumor drug was done only in Germany by the nickname of Promit. And that study was statistically underpowered, and the data is very difficult to interpret. But it was a randomized trial where people who got no octreotide had a time to tumor progression of 7 months approximately, and the people who got the octreotide LAR, it was 14 months. They thought that was very exciting, that the time was doubled, that it was able to control cancer. However, those numbers are incredibly short, and nobody understands exactly what that means. And for that reason, the FDA has never approved it as an anti-tumor drug at this point. Lanreotide was studied by a very big trial that we did, an international trial with hundreds of patients, where there was a randomization between lanreotide and placebo with the understanding that anybody who progressed on placebo would then get active drug. a study being done at a time when standard of care was to do nothing, so that that was felt to be an ethical trial, number one. And number two, everybody was able to get the drug if they needed it because you were able to cross over from placebo to active lanreotide. So that trial, at the time of publication, almost everybody getting lanreotide was doing great, and they didn't even know how long it would keep working. In the subsequent follow-up, I presented that data at ESCO, I believe in 2017, the people that got lanreotide with small intestine carcinoids, which is a population similar to the PROMID trial of octreotide, the average time to progression was 61 and a half months. That's over 5 years of cancer control just from these injections. And that means at the end of 5 years, half of the patients still had not progressed and everything was fine. And many of those patients went on for 10 years or 15 years. I've had patients more than 20 years. It just keeps working. So even though half of the people have progressed by 5 years. So it's an extremely effective and well-tolerated treatment for most people. The other thing about lanreotide, based on that trial, it was approved by the FDA as a treatment for carcinoid tumor, as an anti-tumor drug. As chemotherapy is the anti-tumor drug, this is an anti-tumor drug. The other thing that was done was another trial with lanreotide called ELECT, which was a trial for treating carcinoid syndrome, and it turned out to be highly effective in carcinoid syndrome, so it's been FDA approved for both. The other potential advantage for patients getting lanreotide is it's a subcutaneous injection rather than a deep intramuscular injection. It's a sort of a viscous material, so it's a larger needle than the average self-injected subcutaneous medicine. But it's something where patients go to a doctor's office or their various arrangements for getting lanreotide injections, but they're always a subcutaneous injection rather than an intramuscular injection, which most people find a little more user-friendly. So we really have these two major somatostatin analogs that are being used for neuroendocrine tumor therapy. And one more thing I should add is that there are many, many people out there who were started on octreotide LAR and have been on it for years. And if everything is doing well, there's no compelling reason to change to lanreotide. If you're on octreotide and it's working, it's perfectly fine. It clearly has anti-cancer effects. It works almost an identical way to lanreotide. And even though that PROMID study was so underpowered and wasn't able to show the effectiveness, it is an effective drug, and I don't want anybody receiving it to think they're getting something that's necessarily inferior, because we have no data. They've never been compared against each other.
So that was actually my next question. This is a really fantastic overview of the science behind it and the studies. So if I understand this correctly, the study was really around the symptoms, so flushing and diarrhea, and that's the FDA-approved indication. And lanreotide was both for tumor control and symptom control. So the question does come up in the patient community all the time. How do you decide which one to be on? Do you use one just for symptoms and one just for tumor? Do both of them work for both tumor and symptoms effectively?
They do both work for both indications, for controlling cancer and for controlling symptoms. I would say nowadays, most patients are getting started in my practice with lanreotide because it's more user-friendly on the behind, having a subcutaneous injection rather than an intramuscular injection. And also it's one where the data is so robust. So I don't usually do that. However, there are some patients who may tolerate one better than the other. Some people may have more diarrhea or just prefer one over the other. And it's possible to switch if having a problem with one to go to the other. But I would say that there are other places where people start with octreotide, and I can't fault them. There's just different practices in different places, and people do things differently sometimes in different institutions. But I think that lanreotide is becoming more and more popular, for sure.
Okay, so it sounds like both are used equally for tumor control and symptom control. So you mentioned really impressive data with the trial, the lanreotide trial, of 61 and a half months of stability. So over 5 years of tumor control and some people living.
That's specifically with small intestine primaries, the comparable one to what was studied with octreotide. The same study also included pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. And there's another study called SPINET that was done that we did with lung neuroendocrine tumors. It controls those tumors as well. The period of cancer control appears to be not as long with pancreatic primaries and lung primaries as a statistical average, but it does work.
Thank you for that. Actually, that's very helpful to hear because people, especially long neck people, feel a little left out sometimes. So it has been studied on all of them. So a question comes up very commonly. You talked about the impressive data with stability. Do the somatostatin analogs, octreotide and lanreotide, do they shrink tumors?
Only in some lucky patients. They usually result in stability, often stability for years, but major tumor shrinkage from those drugs is uncommon, certainly less than 5% of the time. One more thing that I should throw out for discussion is that we have a predictor for success of using somatostatin analogs, and that is molecular imaging, looking for somatostatin receptors in the tumor.
Oh, that was my next question. I was just going to ask you, how do you know if it's going to be effective and should all NET patients be on a somatostatin analog?
The way that you know if it's going to be effective, you could predict by a test. The ways that we look for somatostatin receptors in a tumor are with, nowadays, a PET scan, a specialized type of PET scan called a gallium-68 dotatate PET. It's done as a PET CT. You do a CT to localize where the tumors are, but a gallium-68 dotatate PET CT or PET MR. The other is to do the same type of study with copper-64 dotatate. Dotatate is a somatostatin analog. Tate means octreotate. It's almost identical to octreotide that we've been talking about, but that's a somatostatin analog that sticks to the cancer cell, and along with it is attached an isotope that shoots out rays and says, here I am, I'm a cancer. And the more rays it shoots out, the more somatostatin receptors you have in your tumor, and this could be quantitated. It's called a Krenning scale, K-R-E-N-N-I-N-G, named after a well-known nuclear medicine physician in the Netherlands. And using this Krenning scale, we can quantitate how strong the somatostatin receptor binding is. And the stronger the somatostatin receptor binding, the better the response. So we have that molecular test in the form of imaging. There was an older test called an Octreo scan, which is done much less these days because it doesn't have quite the same sensitivity. Although if it is positive strongly, it's very predictive as well of response. There are a few places that can actually measure somatostatin receptors on pathology from a biopsy, and that can also predict response. If you have somatostatin receptors, you have something for the somatostatin analog to stick to. However, the imaging is by far the best. The PET scans with gallium-68 or copper-64, those kind of PET scans are the best because when you do a biopsy, it just tells you what there is in that one spot that was biopsied. But these imaging studies will tell you how much somatostatin receptor you have in all the tumors of the body, wherever they are.
Yeah, so that's helpful. And what about patients whose tumors do not light up on the dotatate scan?
Well, there's different reasons why it might not light up. But if it doesn't light up because there are no somatostatin receptors, then these drugs are not useful. Now, I say it that way because there's some patients who have little teeny-weeny tumors, can have lots of them. What if your liver had tumors like grains of sand or little things all through the liver? They might not show up on a dotatate PET because they're just too small and not enough rays shoot out to make a picture, and you don't know. So those people still might respond very well. Or some people with lung carcinoids that have something called deep neck diffuse idiopathic neuroendocrine cell hyperplasia. But if a lung carcinoid patient has that condition, often the tumors are too tiny to show up, but they almost always respond to using a somatostatin analog. So there are certain circumstances where you might use it despite the fact the scan is negative. There are a few people in the world that just a trial to see if it works might be the only thing possible. There are certain special exceptions, but in general, we'd like to have a scan before we start.
That's really helpful to understand where it fits in with everything else. So it sounds like, as you mentioned with the story of the first patient you saw, it's something you go to early on in someone's treatment journey and after getting a scan.
I think that it has to be viewed as an anti-cancer drug that should be used when it's needed. So in answer to your question, does everybody need a somatostatin analog? The result is no. There's a population of people who don't have the receptors, and there's a population of people who don't need it. Let's say you have a cancer which is completely removed with surgery, whether it's a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor or intestinal neuroendocrine tumor, and you don't have any detectable cancer in your body, you might or might not have a recurrence sometime in your life. Does that person need to have injections every 4 weeks forever? No. I think that you have to make an individual decision based on the risk of cancer growing if you don't have the shot versus the risk of problems if you have the shot. So I think it's an individual decision in those kinds of cases. In people who have metastatic disease, who have somatostatin receptors, I would say in that population, most people would benefit from the medicine.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why it's important to individualize treatment.
Yeah, individualized care. Having evidence of disease, having a dotatate scan that lights up, and talking to a multidisciplinary team or a NET expert to guide that. So on the flip side, how long can someone stay on a somatostatin analog? Some people have expressed concerns about maybe it not working after a period of time or maybe developing resistance to the medication. Does that happen?
Well, medication resistance develops, which is why it only works for a certain period of time, whether it's 5 years, 6 years, or 10 years, or 2 years. After some period of time, cancers develop resistance. And whether it should continue or not continue to that point is something that is sort of an individualized decision that has to be made. Most people continue and add something else, but I think that there's room for discussion in that situation. So it's not a forever thing. Sometimes people go from octreotide to lanreotide if cancer progresses, even though data is not totally solid. Occasionally, somebody will respond to one analog that didn't respond to another. But there's no arbitrary limit where it has to be stopped. And it's basically continued as long as it's working and as long as it can be tolerated well. I should mention also that there's a third commonly used somatostatin analog, and that's octreotide acetate, which is something people can self-inject with a little tiny needle. And that's another way of giving somatostatin analog, whether you need an increased amount over what you could achieve with the every 4 week injection, or if you can't tolerate the every 4 week injection, some people prefer to inject themselves 3 times a day with a little tiny insulin needle. So there are a lot of variations in how things could be done.
Yeah, and that's the one that our patient community will commonly call a rescue shot in addition to their long acting shot. So many patients are concerned about side effects. So what side effects can patients experience from these shots?
Well, all somatostatin analogs have predictable side effects based on the fact they're inhibiting certain hormones and certain enzymes. So the side effects from inhibiting hormones include things like a blood sugar that could be too high, a blood sugar that could be too low, slowing down bile flow in the bile because of a hormone that's called cholecystokinin. It's inhibited by the somatostatin analogs, and it can lead to getting gallstones. And for that reason, anybody who's having abdominal surgery who's taking somatostatin analogs usually gets their gallbladder prophylactically removed while they're having abdominal surgery. Although I certainly would not recommend going to surgery just because you're on a somatostatin analog for taking out a gallbladder if you don't have any problems with your gallbladder. But if you're there anyway taking out a carcinoid tumor and you need to have somatostatin analogs, most people would have their gallbladder taken out at that time. It has lots of uncommon side effects or side effects you could see after a long period of time, lowering thyroid function. But the most important thing that patients become aware of, or what is lumped into the literature, is gastrointestinal toxicity. Gastrointestinal toxicity means abdominal discomfort, bloating, passing too much gas, running to the toilet, having multiple bowel movements, having explosive bowel movements, having all kinds of unpleasant things related to these types of symptoms. These are all related to one common cause and one common treatment. And that is that one of the things that somatostatin analogs do, and when I say somatostatin analogs, I mean octreotide or lanreotide or drugs that are similar. One of the most common things they do is they inhibit the production of pancreatic digestive enzymes. The pancreas makes certain hormones like insulin, which everybody knows about, but most people are not aware that the pancreas also makes something popularly called pancreatic juice. It's a liquid full of enzymes that gets squirted into the intestine every time you eat. And there's a little opening in the duodenum where this pancreatic juice gets blasted in every time you eat. If you don't have enough pancreatic enzymes, you get into trouble. And when lanreotide and octreotide suppress the production of pancreatic enzymes, getting into trouble is common. So here's how you get into trouble. The pancreatic juice contains amylase that digests carbohydrates, trypsin that digests protein, and lipase digests fat. With those three enzymes, you have the ability to eat whatever you want and digest whatever you want. If you don't have those enzymes, eating anything will cause you to have all of the symptoms I've just told you. What happens is that if the food is not totally digested, it goes through the intestinal tract, and by the time it gets to the rectum, where the stool is loaded with bacteria, which is normal for stool to be. The undigested food gets eaten up by the bacteria. And when bacteria eat things, they ferment it, and they make a whole ton of gas. And the root cause of all of this trouble is the bacteria eating your food in your rectum and turning it into a gas factory. So if you eat a pizza and you don't have lipase to digest the fat, and you don't have amylase to digest the carbs, and you eat a bunch of pizza, those bacteria in your gut, in the rectum area, are going to have a pizza party, and you're going to regret it. And you're going to be really miserable. And a lot of people will say, oh, I can't eat this, and I can't eat that, and I have to restrict my diet. But the whole problem is that they don't have enough digestive enzymes. The fix is really simple. You just take a little pill of digestive enzymes before you eat, and then everything is fine. And there's several brands on the market. There are things like Creon and Zenpep. You just have to have a prescription for a pancreatic digestive enzyme mixture that contains lipase, amylase, and trypsin, these three enzymes in an appropriate concentration. And you have to get the dose adjusted right, and you have to take them every time before you eat, in the same way that you would take lactate every time before you eat if you have lactose intolerance and you need lactate enzyme to digest lactose milk sugar. If you eat a triple scoop ice cream sundae and you have lactose intolerance and don't take your pill, you could have exactly the same symptoms. It's just that it requires a different enzyme for fixing. That requires an enzyme to deal with the milk sugar, and this requires an enzyme to deal with carbohydrates, protein, and fat. But I can't tell you how many people I see coming from all over the place being treated by doctors who aren't aware of this particular side effect and are just absolutely miserable or say they can't tolerate it, or have had somatostatin analog therapy stop because of intolerance of toxicity. And all of this could have been fixed with something they call it in the health stores a nutritional supplement, a pill of enzymes you could take before you eat. It's not even a normal medicine. It's just natural enzymes in a pill. So that's my summary of side effects.
That is so helpful. This comes up, I think, almost every single week in our support groups. And we recently covered this on the podcast with a dietitian as well. And this is a huge topic as well. And you mentioned there's different types of enzymes on the market. You need a prescription and that the dose needs to be adjusted. And I'm just wondering, how long does it take to find that balance and the right amount of enzymes? And is it possible to manage all this?
Most of the time it is. Most people start with something like 24,000 units of lipase in a pill, and that comes with the appropriate amount of trypsin and amylase. These three enzymes always come together in fixed amount. And you take one of these before every single snack, two of them before every single meal, and most people are fine. So that's called 24,000 units of lipase. You could also get 36,000 units of lipase in the same kind of pill. And that's a slightly stronger strength. And a lot of people will start with that or go to that if 24,000 doesn't work. And it's only an exceptional person that's still having problems and needs to escalate higher. And if you do, instead of taking one before a snack, you take two. Instead of taking two before a snack, you could take three or four. A meal, you could take three or four. On Thanksgiving, you could take two before a meal and one before the pumpkin pie because you're sitting at a table eating. So you have to get used to the subtleties of it and work with your doctor to have the appropriate strength. It's an expensive medication to have the proper concentration, so it usually needs to go through appropriate channels in the physician's office to get insurance approval and have it sent through a specialty pharmacy. If you just go to the drugstore and ask for a bottle, you could end up with many hundreds of dollars that you wish you didn't have to spend.
That's helpful. So looking at patient assistance programs and working with your doctor's office for that. I guess I'm wondering, who would prescribe that medication? Would it be the oncologist, a gastroenterologist, primary care doctor? Who should patients ask about these pancreatic enzymes like Zenpep and Creon?
Anybody who's really familiar with it and understands it and takes responsibility for managing it and adjusting the dose is able to do it. It could be a gastroenterologist, it could be an oncologist, it could be a surgeon, it could be anybody who's really familiar. I find it very helpful doing that myself since I have a lot of familiarity with this in places where oncologists are not familiar with it and there's a gastrointestinal specialist who is, that's perfectly fine. If there's a surgeon who does pancreatic resections and you don't have a pancreas, well, if the surgeon's patients are getting pancreatic enzymes or they wouldn't be able to function because they're not making pancreatic juices. So some surgeons are very experienced in doing this. Other surgeons don't have a clue. So it just depends on the doctor. But I don't think oncologists necessarily have a monopoly on enzymes.
Yeah. So someone who can be a champion for this. And so you mentioned that somatostatin analogs can cause issues with the gallbladder. Could you explain a little bit more about the correlation and what's going on there in the body?
Well, the gallbladder stores up bile, which is made by the liver. It stores up the bile, and then it blasts it into the intestines every time you eat fat to help digest the fat. I told you about lipase enzyme helps digest fat. Bile helps digest fat also. So the gallbladder stores up the bile and squirts it in the intestine. But if you have your gallbladder taken out, you have a slow drip of bile in your intestine all day. And if you eat fat, you usually have plenty of bile to digest the fat, and you really don't have a problem. If you were living in the age of cavemen and you had nothing to eat for a week, and then somebody killed some 10-ton animal, and all of a sudden you have to eat 10 pounds of meat in one sitting because you're not going to have a meal for the next week, and you wanted to have this huge amount of fat, it's very helpful to have a gallbladder to give you a big blast of bile. But in real life, millions of Americans run around with no gallbladder and do just fine. And a very high percentage of our neuroendocrine patients have no gallbladder and do just fine and don't really have dietary limitations because of that. So it's good to get it out. And if you wait till you get gallstones and if they cause trouble, you can get a really severe infection in your gallbladder, which could even be life-threatening. And it could be a problem, and that leads to urgent gallbladder removals, cholecystectomies. So if you can do that electively at the time you're in there anyway, having abdominal surgery, which so many people with neuroendocrine tumors of the pancreas and intestine have, it's a good time to take it out.
Okay, that helps explain why many people are advised to have their gallbladder out at the same time as other surgeries, particularly for neuroendocrine tumor. Another medication that sometimes gets brought up in neuroendocrine tumor community is medications for bile acids, cholestyramine. What do you think about using those medications?
Diarrhea from carcinoid syndrome is caused by lots and lots of things, not just somatostatin analogs, not just carcinoid syndrome. And actually, we had a big national meeting of oncologists who are experienced in this sort of thing, and it's been published in a whole paper on the differential diagnosis of carcinoid syndrome diarrhea, discussing all the different things. But bile acid sequestrants are not things that relate specifically to the somatostatin analogs we're talking about today, but that treats another kind of diarrhea that can happen in carcinoid patients, which is a lack of enough absorbing of the bile in the end of the small intestine in the distal ileum, where it absorbs bile. And there's a whole system that that happens with. If you use a medicine like cholestyramine, it absorbs the bile and helps prevent that problem and can stop so-called bile acid diarrhea. It doesn't work in everybody. It just works in people with that specific diagnosis. And usually it's a good idea to make that diagnosis before starting this medicine. Is not something I would start right away. Occasionally it started as a trial just to see how it works in the real world, but it's a diagnosis you can usually make in advance. There are multiple other causes of diarrhea in carcinoid patients, including carcinoid syndrome, having a short gut, having bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine. There's a long list of things. And it's really appropriate treatment for the appropriate kind of diarrhea that's going to make the biggest difference. So if you are having diarrhea and it's not the so-called malabsorption, it's steatorrhea, which is what we call not having enough digestion of your foods in the small intestine leading to the symptoms I was telling you about, I think it's really important to have a proper gastrointestinal evaluation and make sure there isn't something else going on from one of these other causes. People even can have undiagnosed inflammatory bowel disease or ulcerative colitis. Some people have underlying irritable bowel. There's a long, long list of things that could happen, and you really need a good gastroenterologist on the case if you're having diarrhea that's refractory to standard things for treating carcinoid syndrome and treating enzyme deficiency.
Thank you, Dr. Wolin, really for highlighting how complex the issue of diarrhea can be. We understand that, yes, you can have diarrhea from the disease. You can have diarrhea from these monthly shots. And as you said, there's many other causes, and it's not just a knee-jerk, okay, start this or that. It requires seeing someone who knows, and we have whole educational programs just on the topic of diarrhea, so that's really helpful to hear. This is very complex. What about diabetes? People also bring that up as a concern. Do somatostatin analogs cause diabetes?
Diabetes is caused by either not having enough insulin or not having the insulin working properly. Somatostatin analogs can inhibit insulin and can inhibit glucagon, which is the hormone that works the opposite direction as well. Some people that have a tendency towards diabetes might end up getting diabetes as a result of the treatment with diabetes being a laboratory diagnosis based on having too high a blood sugar. However, if you're not taking a somatostatin analog, it doesn't mean that the pancreas is not functioning anymore and the blood sugar will come back down again. But some people really need it. Most people who have normal pancreas function, normal blood sugars, and they take these somatostatin analogs don't have a problem with blood sugar. Almost everybody is able to tolerate it without a problem. People that have prediabetes that have a tendency to a blood sugar that's too high, some people might have already had things like gestational diabetes or diabetes associated with gaining more weight, and then they take somatostatin analog on top of it. Those people are particularly susceptible to having the glucose get high enough that they need treatment. Treatment usually being very successful with an oral pill, and it's usually not necessary to use insulin unless there's somebody who already is a pre-existing diabetic and the diabetes gets worse as a result of the treatment.
Yeah, thank you. So it can cause high blood sugars or diabetes, and it sounds like the priority is to treat the tumor, and diabetes can be managed if that happens.
Another side effect of somatostatin analogs, which is uncommon, but it can happen, is a slowing down of the heart rate. We call it bradycardia. That's an uncommon side effect. In some individuals, it can be serious, particularly if their heart is running too slow to start with. There's a long list of things that are not very common.
Okay. I know one that the patients are mainly concerned about is the soreness that they get after the injection. So what might you recommend to prevent or manage that soreness?
Okay. The most important thing in managing the soreness is making sure the person giving the shot is really experienced in giving the shot and does the injection according to the manufacturer's recommendations. Surprisingly, a lot of people think they know how to give subcutaneous injections because they've done it all their life, giving people shots of things like insulin or epinephrine or heparin or other things that are given subcutaneously with a little needle and you inject. Lanreotide is a so-called deep subcutaneous injection. Instead of going in at a 45-degree angle, the needle needs to go straight in and go deeper than it does for a normal subcutaneous injection. And if people give it too close to the surface, it's very painful, gives a painful bump, and patients really hate that. So it's important to give the injection properly. The actual giving of the injection, if it's done slowly and it's given in the right place, is usually not too bad. It's only an occasional patient getting, I'm talking about lanreotide right now, it's really not a very common thing to have a lot of injection problems with lanreotide, but it's more common with octreotide LAR. With injections of either medicine, though, that are causing problems, there are some topical things that could be done to the skin to make it not hurt. One is to spray it with something called ethyl chloride. It makes the skin sort of freeze for a second. You give the injection and it hurts less. People use topical local anesthetics on the skin to try to make it hurt less. But again, the most important thing is really good injection technique. And with octreotide LAR, it needs to be warmed up properly. It needs to be given properly so that you don't end up having the material crystallize in the needle and somebody working really, really hard to get that medicine in. And it's so expensive and they don't want to waste it and they want to get it in. And by the time they finish, you end up with a much more painful rear than you would otherwise. So if you follow the manufacturer's directions very, very carefully for both products, you're going to have less trouble.
So perhaps patients finding a nurse that knows how to do it or familiarizing them themselves so that they can...
Yeah, just make sure the nurses are aware.
I know that both companies that make the shots will send nurse educators to guide them if they need more in-servicing. Mm-hmm. So we talked about side effects and we talked about how this is used for the right patient. If the tumor is growing, does this mean that the somatostatin analog is not working?
Well, if the tumor is growing while you're on a somatostatin analog, it means it is not working adequately, for sure. Otherwise, it wouldn't be growing.
So then do you continue it if you start adding another treatment? Like if they move on to a different drug, do you continue on a somatostatin analog? Or what do you do with it? Do you stop it? Do you continue it? How do you decide this?
The bottom line is that we don't know with 100% certainty what the answer to that question is, because no study has ever been done where half the people get continued somatostatin analog and half the people don't. And until there is such data, which will probably never happen, we'll probably never have a total answer. The thought is, in most places, that you're better off continuing the somatostatin analog because it'll help continue to control the carcinoid syndrome or the neuroendocrine syndromes. It probably helps slow down the growth of cancer. Even though it's growing, it might grow faster if you don't have that medicine on board. Since you know your cancers have lots of somatostatin receptors, and these drugs can inhibit that. So if you have a strongly positive scan and you've been on the medication, most people continue it unless you're having PRRT. For PRRT, you have to hold the injection before PRRT because it can interfere with the treatment. But otherwise, most people will continue. However, there are some places that people don't continue. There are some patients who have a really hard time tolerating it, and there's no absolute proof they need it. That would be a good time to stop it and do something else. In general, with chemotherapy, if something doesn't work, you say, okay, let's move on and not do it anymore. But this is a little different than normal chemotherapy. It's a little bit like the case in prostate cancer, where people are treated for prostate cancer with an anti-androgen. You don't want the testosterone level to be high, and that's considered a good treatment for prostate cancer. But at some point, the cancer can become resistant and start growing. So what do? You have to start chemotherapy. But the urologic oncologists keep up the anti-testosterone program because they're afraid if the testosterone goes up to normal, it's going to speed up the growth of the prostate cancer like crazy, and it's going to make things get even worse. So you continue that and continue the chemotherapy at the same time. So we think it might be analogous to that, but we don't know with certainty. And if we did, we wouldn't be continuing it. But I'd say the majority of patients stay on their somatostatin analog, but not everybody.
Yeah, you said some really important things there. And one is this understanding that works differently than maybe some other drug that you're adding on to it, like a chemotherapy, so that perhaps they're working together. But even if you have to add something else, it can help with symptom control and perhaps slowing down the tumor growth, even if it didn't stop it altogether.
Right.
Okay. So let's end with this last question. What is the future of somatostatin analogs? I heard there's a pill maybe available in clinical trial. So can I get a pill instead of an injection in the future?
Sure. So let's talk about that for a little while. And also, just one more potential side effect that I just wanted to mention in the previous subject was that people who are pregnant should not be taking somatostatin analogs because it can cause severe problems in a developing baby. So that's something that really needs to be very carefully discussed with physicians and people that are pregnant.
That's helpful because there are younger people diagnosed.
Definitely.
Thank you.
There's a lot of really exciting stuff happening in the world of somatostatin analog. One is the pill Lisa just mentioned. Okay. There is a medication that goes by the nickname of CAM-2029. This is made by a company called Camurus. CAM-2029. It's still investigational. It's not available for everybody, but that's not a pill. It's an injection. But I'm going to talk to you about this first, and then I'm going to talk to you about the pill. CAM-2029 is octreotide, just like Sandostatin. However, it's formulated into a really unusual preparation that we call fluid crystal injection. This is a different formulation than we've ever had before, and I think it's one of the advances in where we're going with somatostatin therapy as we lean towards the future. This is injected with a little itty-bitty needle, the same kind that people use to inject insulin. A little tiny injection that people can easily self-inject, but something happens extraordinarily after the injection. It instantly gels up into a gel when it hits body fluid. So as soon as you inject it, it forms a little blob of sustained-release material that will then sit there and sustain release over subsequent weeks. That's pretty amazing. But this could be given in the abdominal wall, the thigh, anywhere people would give an insulin shot. And anybody can really do this for themselves and not have to be tied to trips to a doctor's office. That's huge because one injection every 2 weeks with a little itty-bitty needle is a very simple thing to do. The other thing is it's stable at room temperature, unlike octreotide. So you can carry this around. You could take it on trips. You could go wherever you want, just as you would with insulin. And after it's in the subcutaneous tissues and forms this little blob, it's then biodegradable and it gradually goes into the body as Sandostatin. It's also possible to give much higher doses in a very tiny volume because the needle is so tiny. And if you wanted to double the dose and give it every week, you could double the dose and give it every week. So potentially it would be terrific. So there is a trial right now comparing this medication, the CAM-2029, versus dealer's choice of a somatostatin analog, either octreotide or lanreotide. The trial is only for people with carcinoid syndrome. I think it's going to be closed fairly soon, and hopefully we're going to have answers soon. If it turns out to be as good as we hope it's going to be, it may end up getting approved sooner rather than later, and it may be a huge benefit for people who are right now having to go to a physician's office every 4 weeks indefinitely to have an injection in the behind. That's advance number one in this field. Advance number two is a pill. there is a pill that goes by the name of paltusotine. It's a funny name, which is a medicine that is a somatostatin agonist. It works just like octreotide and lanreotide. It works on the same somatostatin receptor as octreotide and lanreotide, but it is a pill. And that's huge. It's a once-a-day pill. And that's on a clinical trial right now in carcinoid syndrome. The first drug is open to people with all kinds of carcinoid and neuroendocrine tumors, but this is specifically carcinoid syndrome patients. And the reason that was done is that this way it can get to its primary endpoint on the research trial much faster, because you can say, okay, you're having 10 diarrheas a day, and now you're having 4 diarrheas a day or formed bowel movements a day. You'll know very quickly what the answer is. Whereas if you do a trial waiting to see how long before cancer progresses, you might have to wait for 10 years before the drug finally becomes approved. So this may lead to an approval sooner rather than later. And it's a trial that's going on right now in carcinoid syndrome. It's reaching the time that it's going to be closed for accruing new patients to the trial. And we're going to have data coming out fairly soon on the effectiveness. And hopefully it's going to be on the market before too long. So this is amazing. So I think we have two potential major advances with somatostatin analogs that will make a difference in quality of life in a major way. There's another oral pill known as Mycapssa. It's made by another company, Chiasma, that was being developed, and it doesn't seem to be getting as much press these days. I'm not sure where we stand with that one, but the one that looks like it's ahead of the rest of the pack is the paltusotine. So I just wanted you to be aware of these things that are happening.
That's really exciting. Dr. Rowland, there's a lot that's happened in your 25 plus years in the neuroendocrine tumor field. I meant looking back and looking forward. It's amazing to see how far you've come and what's going on ahead. And I just want to offer you the chance to, I guess, share any closing comments, thoughts, words of hope with the neuroendocrine tumor community that is so near and dear to your heart.
Well, I think that we're in a very, very exciting time. Before, let's say, 2011, there was only one drug that was ever approved, and that was streptozocin for pancreatic neuroendocrine cancers, a very obnoxious drug that had to be administered intravenously every week. And it was really not a very good situation, and there was nothing for intestinal carcinoids. After 2011, there's been approximately 7 more drugs getting approved. We now have everolimus and lanreotide and telotrastat for carcinoid syndrome and PRRT with lutetium-177 dotatate, Lutathera. And we have all these different drugs that have recently got approved. We have really exciting data on cabozantinib. We just closed the cabozantinib National Clinical Trial. The data were presented within the last couple of weeks at the European Society of Medical Oncology. Results are awesome. And I think we're going to have an approval on that very shortly. And that's going to be another really good drug for all kinds of neuroendocrine tumors, including lung and pancreas and intestinal carcinoids and neuroendocrine tumors. We have really huge advances in PRRT, including alpha-emitting isotopes like actinium-225 and lead-212 isotopes. And we have so many things that are happening in the field that I hope result in much longer and much higher quality lives for all of our patients.
Thank you for being a part of that, of expanding the field, of pushing the boundaries. And may we continue to push the boundaries and get more treatments out there so that people can do the things they enjoy, right? Enjoy the classical music, get back to those things that they enjoy so they're not just surviving, but really, truly thriving. So thank you for all you've done in the past and continue to do and will do in the future for the neuroendocrine cancer community. We're very grateful for you.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the LACNETS podcast. Go to our website, lacnets.org/podcast, for episode transcripts and resources. We want to thank our podcast supporters, Ipsen, ITM, Crinetics, Curium, and Boehringer Ingelheim. For more information about neuroendocrine cancer, go to www.lacnets.org. LACNETS depends on donations to bring you programs such as this podcast. Please consider making a donation at lacnets.org/donate.